28079, State of Hawaii, versus Robert Mitchell. Pro part for the appellant, Lauren Thomas for the appellant, argument on merits.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Hart, I understand that you're going to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. Okay, if you'd care to proceed, and Mr. Mitchell, you can be seated.
Good morning, members of the court, Judge Foley, Judge Nakamura, Chief Judge Rechtenwald. May it please the court. This case involves a man who, prior to this trial and these findings by Judge Wilson, had been a member of the Department of Water Supply, Water Contamination Detection Force for 14 years, a father of two children, and otherwise a completely unremarkable citizen when it came to the criminal justice process. He was a member of a church. Many of the members of the church are here in the court today, I dare say probably more than 50 people. And he had had considerable difficulties with his wife, married in 1992. Child, Anna Mitchell, born in 1994, of course, is the complainant in this case. Judge Wilson's findings are findings that I urge the court to find do not amount to, do not support the notion of substantial evidence. That is, if the test on appeal is whether there was substantial evidence to support the conclusions of the trier of fact, this must be credible evidence, which is of sufficient quality and probative value to enable a person of reasonable caution to support a conclusion. Now, Judge Wilson said, I believe Hannah, I don't believe Robert.
Why is that?
Well, in some cases, it might be enough. And in this case, it's not enough because you have to look at all the circumstances that preceded the allegations, including significantly that when the couple separated in 1996, there was an immediate claim of sexual abuse that Karen made against Mr. Mitchell.
All those arguments that you're raising here in your brief made to the trier of fact?
Well,
given the way our system works, isn't that primarily the credibility call for the trier of fact?
In most cases, that would be true. In a case involving a six-year-old who is making claims against an adult who has no history, no indication, no suggestion of ever having committed any offense as an adult, there needs to be more. I think before the modern age, some 30 years ago, when there was a cry for similar treatment for these types of cases as there was for others, many states had laws that required more corroboration. And why would that be? As a parent, we know that children can be manipulated, that children can be taught, that children are very suggestible, and so injustice can result from that. So there needs to be more than just the credibility. There needs to be more, particularly in light of the facts in this case, that these accusations were made first at the time of separation in 1996, then again at the time of the divorce filings in the year of the divorce divorce filings in later in 96. The first accusation was in February. The second accusation at the time of the divorce filing was in August, and the separation accusation, or the separation, occurred in January of 96. So you have this remarkable situation. January 96, a separation. February 96, the first accusation. Then you have August 96, the divorce filing, and September 96, the next accusation. And when the couple finally got to a point in March of 2000. What happened in March? Mr. Mitchell said that he and Mary, who is his suspect and wife is seated there in the audience. We're returning from the Philippines, her home, and Mr. Mitchell sought to have custody readdressed. And immediately, 2 weeks later, these accusations came out. Judge Wilson did not address this remarkable pattern. He didn't address the fact that these accusations had been made over and over again, and of course CPS had rejected them the first two times. And then the third time is remarkably studded with non-evidence. The child went to see the doctor. There was no sign on April 5th, 2000 that the child had been penetrated. There was no evidence of sexual abuse. Now it's easy to say, okay, these tissues are tissues that heal quickly. But what was described was a shovel or a spoon. And those of us who are parents, and Judge Wilson has no children, would know that that is probably, that thing with the wings, is probably that 6-inch cylindrical object that has a protector so the child won't swallow it, that goes against the teeth, and which is used to administer liquid medication. Now believe me, it doesn't take being a judge or a doctor or anybody, it just takes a person of reasonable caution and common sense to know that if you are jamming that up your daughter's private parts, and in this case both the vagina and the anus were mentioned, you would expect to see something, particularly when the testimony was that skin came off and there was blood. But that isn't what the child said to the doctor the first time around. She just said, he was touching me. And of course he was touching her, because as parents we all know, when our children, particularly our daughters, have diaper rash, have some irritation in that area, we get Desitin, we get A&D ointment, we go to the doctor. What kind of a sex abuser takes his kid to the doctor every time she has a rash? In 1996, when these accusations were first made, he and Karen went to the doctor. They went to the psychologist too. Nothing was found. Then, in the period leading up to the accusations, in March of 2000, in February of 2000, and previously in 1999 and 1998, the child had rashes. The last meeting with the doctor before the accusations was February 8th.
Is there any corroboration for the defendant's testimony that he was administering medication for a yeast infection for his daughter?
Well, the corroboration was his testimony about these events, Drs. Amos and...
Is there any corroboration in the form of medical records? Or
well, there actually is, and I
but
couldn't...
But in the case?
I didn't see it to have been presented, but it wasn't challenged either. The government would have challenged it. Common sense tells you if he hadn't taken the child to Dr. Rovner and Dr. Amos, Dr. Moore and Dr. Dazzani, in the situations in which he testified, while not mentioning by name, Kahala Pediatrics was the main place he took them. The government didn't challenge that. Now, have any of us ever heard of a child abuser who takes the child to the doctor for an examination when the accusation is made? I haven't. Maybe you have. But there's no evidence that there was any injury. Now, it wasn't like there was some just touching. The accusation was that it became progressively more exciting. There were first a finger, then some kind of a spoon, then something like knives, then something that had bits and parts and pieces and was electric. Nobody ever found any dildos or anything else, and we all know dildos don't have sharp objects in them. There was allegedly blood and skin coming off. Now, why would this be? Because when the child went to the doctor on April 5th, there wasn't anything to be seen. It was the absence of evidence that Judge Wilson focused on. Well, how can anything be more of a catch-22? You allegedly assaulted your daughter. And because the daughter, Judge Wilson said, didn't say more than that. She didn't seem to be trying to get you in her testimony. She didn't make an accusation that you did other things wrong. Therefore, she must be credible. Yes, Your Honor.
One thing or area I think would be helpful to the court for you to explore is the prejudice that I believe your claim the defense suffered by not Dr. Rhodes not being able to testify. If you could describe what Dr. Rhodes' testimony would have been and how that testimony was restricted, and then we'll move on to why you believe it should have been admitted.
Yes, thank you. Well, first, the case suffers from this problem. In the matters relating to the motions in limine, there were apparently some lengthy chambers conferences that were never recorded. So there isn't a clear record about what was said and what Mr. Takahashi represented to the court. After all, the case is also cabined by this problem. Mr. Mitchell was unfortunately represented by a now disbarred lawyer, Mark Thomason, for several years until 2004, until Mr. Takahashi came into the case. In this particular day that the motions in limine relating to keeping out Dr. Rhodes' testimony was held, there were chambers conferences that weren't reported. So,
did the defense file written objections to the motions in limine?
Well, the defense objected, I guess, in chambers, but I couldn't find
writing. So there's no written.
I couldn't find any.
That says we object to the motion.
I couldn't find any, but it appears that there must have been some degree of discussion about it, but the record's silent.
But did the defense put on the record that they objected to the court's ruling after the chambers conference?
It didn't seem that it did, and maybe that's incompetence of counsel, but it's vague. This is a classic situation of an innocent man convicted in a series of small, seemingly innocuous mistakes that resulted in a finding that he was guilty because of what wasn't in the record. You remember that, and let me get back to your question, Judge Rechtenwald. Dr. Rhodes treated the Mitchells, and Karen, the brief of the government says, one time in the 44 months before 2000. But there were at least 10 meetings with Karen and Mr. Mitchell. I think the children were present. In one report, Rhodes wrote, the question has been raised as to whether it was possible for Karen Mitchell coached her daughter in the allegations of sexual abuse. The psychotherapy sessions with Robert Mitchell with the children present and subsequent Child Protective Service interviews with the minor children have suggested coaching of the children in several areas. And then they were delineated in a later report. He should have been permitted to testify about that. Not because it would be proper to have him testifying about the credibility of the child, which Patangan and subsequent cases have condemned, and properly so, but because it was crucial to Mr. Mitchell's defense to be able to show that Karen was a person who would have, and in this case, Mr. Mitchell believes, did coach the child along with the help of her mother. The mother never testified, but there is in the materials a place where it suggests that after the mother talked to Hannah, and Hannah was barely 6 years old, Hannah came and told her mother that there was something to tell her. And then the accusation came forward. Nothing about knives, nothing about objects in the vagina, but that Daddy touched me, which of course is true. He did touch her. We all touch our children in order to apply the proper medication. So the answer to the question is, Dr. Rhodes would have been able to present, if we are committed to the notion that due process, the right to a fair trial, the right to confront witnesses and to present a defense are paramount to any psychotherapist patient privilege, are more important than any confidentiality in the context of a psychological counseling session. In order to get at the truth of who was this that manipulated the child. The government claimed that Karen had a long history of having been sexually abused herself, including the insertion of sticks in her vagina. That would be part of what Dr. Rhodes would have testified to had he been allowed to.
Did the defense ask the mother that question on cross-examination?
Wasn't allowed to. Was barred from asking about her personal history and other personal matters. It's not, but it's obviously so because that's what the motion in limine sought to keep out. Any questions such as she might have said.
Wasn't it framed in terms of the psychotherapist's patient privilege? In other words, the evidence that would have been revealed pursuant to a violation of that privilege was kept out. But there would be no similar privilege if you simply asked the mother that question.
Well, maybe not. And perhaps the lawyer failed to do it because he thought that the court's ruling included those kinds of questions because they were the kinds of things that were disclosed in the therapy. Now look, you've got a situation here. You could easily say, okay, the trial court found one credible and not the other. You could easily say that the record's not silent on this, the defendant waived it. But I'm suggesting that the plain error rule seeks the notion, which establishes the principle that where there is injustice, where you are left with a discomforting feeling that something went wrong here, there are too many things that are so inconsistent with what we know as human beings, that plain error occurred. When the judge has to rely on what wasn't said, as Judge Wilson did, he said in his on-the-record findings, it's significant that in the interview with Hannah with Hinda Diamond, she repeatedly declined the opportunity to describe additional acts done by her father that she didn't like, including her denial that he ever caused her to touch him. So that didn't happen, therefore this must have. Sometimes that's effective. But there's too much of it. The picture, you've seen the picture. Evidence that was supposed to be Mr. Mitchell backing down the hallway trying to keep Hannah in the bathroom. But what does it show? It shows a stick picture of what might be a child on a rug and what might be a man in a doorway. And that is arrogated.
Yes.
You have a few more minutes left.
All right.
Of course, we'll hear from you on rebuttal. But Dr. Rhodes would have testified to his opinion that the mother in this case was capable of coaching or had coached?
Exactly. Not only capable, her entire history was one of a histrionic personality. And a histrionic personality tries to be the attention getter. And the government claimed in its brief that, but the attention was on Hannah. And what do we know? What do we know about Munchausen syndrome by proxy, where the parent gets the child to be the center of attention in order to meet the parent's psychological needs? All of that would have been key to this case, and an injustice was done because the court was not able to hear it. Now, who should the court have been? Just briefly before I have to sit down. In this case, Judge Sakamoto, who was the judge for most of the events in this case, said, I'll be the judge. What's more important to a defendant than knowing who his or her decision maker is going to be? You're going to waive a jury? Well, who's the judge going to be? No, I'm not going to waive a jury with that judge. I'll take a jury before I go to trial before that judge. So Judge Sakamoto did nothing intentionally a wrong to mislead the defendant, but he did tell the defendant he would be the judge.
Bottom line, Mr. Hart, you're asking us, you're making a plain error pitch, because in this case, obviously, there was no objection to the different judge presiding before the trial of the case.
True.
Correct? And in terms of the motion in limine, there was no proffer made by the defense as to what Dr. Rhodes would say, or no objection stated on the record as to objecting to the court's ruling. In terms of what was permitted to be testified.
Well, that's two questions. I think a proffer was probably made in chambers, but you're right. There's nothing
on the
record.
So you're asking us to speculate about what happened in the chambers.
I'm asking you to project what one would expect a lawyer would do, and when the lawyer is told this is what the ruling is, he ethically has to keep within it. The case suffers from these spots, and this man is looking at 20 years in prison as a result of the blank spot. Yes, Your Honor.
It's not raised in the briefs.
Sure.
It just bothers me a little bit. You said most of the information given to Dr. Rhodes was at 10 meetings or so where Mr. Mitchell and his former wife were both present.
That's correct. 8 to 10 meetings where they were both present. There were meetings with Mrs.
So why isn't there a waiver of the privilege as to that information since Mr. Mitchell was there?
Mr. Mitchell waived any privilege as to himself, but
as to the ex-woman.
Mrs. Mitchell, the guardian ad litem as to Hannah, and the prosecutor as to Mrs. Mitchell, both asserted the privilege on the record. That's clear.
Can you assert the privilege after the information is previously been released?
Well, an excellent point, and I'm not sure what the answer is, but I would suggest that it would be of no significance to do that. In this case, the information about her histrionic personality and what that would have meant in the case could have made a real difference for Mr. Mitchell. And Judge Sakamoto should have been the judge because he said he was going to be. Thank you.
Mr. Hart, we'll hear from you on your rebuttal. And right now, Ms. Thomas, for your argument, please.
Good morning. Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Lauren Thomas on behalf of the state. May I please support? With respect to, the court's facing three issues here. The first issue being the, what basically boils down to a credibility issue, and I don't want to belabor that point because Judge Wilson did consider all the arguments that Mr. Hart made today and ultimately believed the child victim in this case and so in favor ruled for the state. There are a couple points I would just make real quickly as to issue three because I don't want to belabor that point as well. Again, there was no objection when Judge Wilson appeared on the scene as the judge to do the trial. Defense counsel and defendant were never equivocal when they were suddenly faced in court with a different judge and not Judge Sakamoto. There were no motions filed. I didn't see anything on the record that gives one the impression that suddenly there was a concern now and we'd like to reinstate our right to a jury trial.
Why the substitution occurred?
It doesn't that I could tell, and I could only think it had to do with some scheduling matter, but that's not on the record, but that's what my recollection is. And again, there was no post-verdict motions challenging Judge Wilson having been on the been the trier of fact, or that defendant again wanted to reinstate his right to a jury trial based on the reasons that he asserted now on appeal. With respect to what I think is really the central issue here, which is the testimony of Dr. Rhodes, I think it's clear on this record that there were no objections made, so then the court looks to a plain error review. And my sense after reading everything, and this record is pretty huge, and these cases usually are when we're dealing with companion, if you will, CPS proceedings, divorce allegations, divorce proceedings, and the record gets quite huge. I don't think I've ever seen a case where there's been more motions in limine. And I think it was the concern of the parties that there was a lot of information that came out of the CPS proceedings. Information specifically through Dr. Rhodes that just would not be admissible in a criminal proceeding on either side. Now, with respect to the issue of coaching, I just think that is a Batangan violation through and through. Now, there's case authority on the mainland where, in a case such as this, where you may have impeachment evidence or impeachment testimony against the victim or the mother, that there's false memory syndrome, that there was coaching, that in those type of cases, sometimes the state will get the opportunity in a rebuttal case to call an expert that the victim wasn't coached. But I'm not even confident that that would be
a
good idea.
Well, it would be a Batangan violation. Batangan says that the prosecution can't call an expert witness to say the victim is telling the truth. It isn't impeachment for credibility, bias, and truthfulness always in play. So why couldn't you put on evidence that the child victim was biased or untruthful in the sense that she was being coached by someone else?
Well, I think the way it was the way it's being posited in this case is they wanted to have Dr. Rhodes testify, which would have been his testimony, that she was coached, that he didn't believe the allegations, and that mother was perfectly capable of coaching her, and he did believe she coached her. I think the coaching whole issue is just a comment on credibility, either directly or implicitly. It is a comment on credibility. I think it connects that last dot. I'm sorry.
Opinion and reputation testimony on character for untruthfulness is admissible under 608. So why wouldn't this qualify as under Rule 608 as testimony, that opinion testimony on the character of either the mother or the child? I guess more appropriate in this case would be character of the mother for being biased or untruthful or schemer or whatever.
Well, I think that you're looking at Dr. Rhodes from the vantage point of being an expert, so then you're looking at Rule 702, and I still see that when his testimony as to coaching, and if Your Honor is also speaking to some of the other statements that they wanted Dr. Rhodes to testify, I can get into that, whether she's histrionic and some of the other comments, but I still have a firm belief that any type of mention of coaching, that he believes she was coached, the potential was coached based on what he's seen in this case, just still speaks to credibility. And it connects that last dot for the trier of fact that just shouldn't.
Dr. Rhodes, correct me if I'm wrong on this, did he interview the mother shortly after the allegations were made within a few days and observed in his opinion that she had a flat affect at that time?
Okay, I think that was one of the statements that he brought up. And as I recall, I know that's an issue they're bringing up on appeal, that they're taking that, his perception or his view of her biological response to what the discussion was that they were having, as that she didn't believe the allegations. But I think as the record shows, he acknowledged that that response could be one of a number of things. Could be shock over the allegations, could be she was numb over the allegations, and
wouldn't that go to the weight of the evidence rather than the sentence?
Well, this, whether she believed the allegations or just her flat affect.
Flat affect and the conclusions that he draws based on his experience, training, and expertise.
Yeah, I guess, right, I guess if we get beyond, in my recollection of the record, it just is so inconclusive as to that whole context of the state that comment or his observation came out. Because a lot of this is coming out in the CPS proceedings, and not having a record in the criminal case, and we just go and look at that, it wasn't developed for purposes of a criminal proceeding. And in that course of that examination, he acknowledged that, well, it could be any number of one of things.
Can you give us some background? What is Dr. Rhodes' role in this whole thing? And going back to Judge Foley's question, if they had joint counseling sessions, why would information revealed in a joint session be subject to the privilege?
Okay, I know there was, with the CPS proceedings, there were two other doctors involved, and I think those were akin to court-appointed doctors for the CPS proceedings. Dr. Rhodes was not one of them. He's always been defendant's therapist. He was called in as a defense witness, if you will, parent's witness for himself in that case. So he's always been a therapist for defendant. He wasn't called in to assist the court on the CPS determination that they had to make. And with respect to Judge Foley's question, I know that wasn't litigated in the briefs, and that is an interesting issue, but my immediate reaction is you don't automatically waive that patient psychologist client, I think they call it, privilege just because maybe your spouse is there or your child is there. But I'm not sure, Your Honor. But that would
be. You have case law that you're talking to your lawyer in the hallway and people over here is waived.
Right.
Do you think the Bassetti test applies, the three-part test?
I know that was briefed, and I think when you look at the individual statements, I have five areas.
The three parts, and it wasn't broken down in the briefs.
Okay.
Certainly by defendant's position, they would meet this three-part test, and that would allow the waiver of the privilege to confront witnesses. legitimate need to disclose protected information. Information is relevant and material. And the party seeking to pierce the privilege shows by preponderance of evidence there's no less intrusive source for that information. Now, wouldn't they seem to at least meet that three-part test, say? And if so, then the privilege can be waived.
Well, I know that in the state's answering brief, we argued that no, and you're right, it didn't go into specifically each breakdown, each one of the three aspects of Pacetti that you look at, as you said, the legitimate need. Was it central to his defense? I would suggest that some of these statements that he wanted to make, and there's five of them, that mother and victim were histrionic, that mother didn't believe the sex assault allegations, mother was sexually abused as a child, the statement that it's okay to lie sometimes into a defendant, and then finally that the mother said that the defendant would kill them or the new wife would kill them and take defendant's money. I think those are the five areas that they seem to be pinpointing in their brief, that these should have come in for these reasons. But I think when you look at a number of them, I don't think that he has overcome the Pacetti three-step test.
But you would agree that's the test.
I would agree, yeah. For a number of these, I would agree. For the last one, the testimony of Rhodes would be that the child told him that her mother told her that defendant's new wife would kill them and take all the money or something to that effect. There's obvious hearsay within hearsay problems in that. And
didn't the mother acknowledge that sort of?
She did.
Kind of acknowledged that.
She did. She acknowledged that through cross-examination.
Doesn't that satisfy the third prong of Pacetti, which is at least less intrusive means of violating the privilege? You can get it directly from the source.
Right. And I would agree that maybe possibly asking the mother some of these questions could have come out in cross.
Are you aware of any ruling by the court that prohibited the defense from asking the mother about her prior child abuse, her prior abuse allegations, under the theory that would have provided a basis for the defense to argue that that showed why she could coach the child, which I think was a defense theory?
Right. It was a defense theory. It was presented throughout examination of the witnesses and very thoroughly in the written closing argument.
So any ruling by the court that you're aware of that prohibited inquiry into that area of the mother's prior abuse?
No. Not at all. I went through a number of the motions in limine to try and match it up with the court's ruling, and at times it's kind of cryptic, but I think you can see where he granted and where he didn't allow. But that first ruling he made, he wanted to be cautious, it seemed to me anyway, that to follow 702, and then whatever went on behind the scenes off the record in Chambers Conference, that's hard for all of us to tell at this point. But I have to think that Mr. Takahashi, coming back on the record, did not put anything in writing, and at least didn't put anything on the record, so that at least tells me that he wasn't so offended by some of the parameters put on Dr. Rhodes' testimony.
Takahashi gave effective representation.
From everything I've seen, yes.
Well, was the CPS proceedings part of the record? In other words, did the judge know what Dr. Rhodes had previously testified at the CPS hearing?
It's hard to say that he couldn't have known, that he didn't know. It is part of the record in the sense that whole testimony of Dr. Rhodes, and I have a copy of it here, is attached to one of the motions in limine. I can't remember if it's motion in limine number 7 or the one precluding inappropriate testimony, but it is there, and it was there for review. It is designated in the record on appeal. Now, whether it was actually admitted into evidence, that I'm not positive about.
Coming back to the testimony about the histrionic personality disorder, which was Dr. Rhodes' opinion, and that potential effect on the mother's ability to coach the child, do you believe that satisfied the Pacetti test or did not satisfy it?
The
testimony about his opinion that the mother had a histrionic personality disorder and that would have been something relevant to assessing her ability to coach this child.
You know, I see in the briefs that they put in a definition of histrionic disorder. It was kind of a limited definition because when I looked at the DSM book, I saw a much lengthier definition of it with associated features, lively, dramatic, prone to exaggeration, perceived to lack genuineness. Person may appear more sad. I mean, it comes from the old, I think they used to call it the hysterical disorder. Does that mean that a person is lies? I don't think so.
In Dr. Rhodes' opinion, though, in other words, is the diagnosis of the histrionic personality disorder linked to his conclusion that the mother coached the child, or is it just independent? He's just independently saying, well, I looked at her and this is where I categorize her in terms of the DSM-4 or 5 or whatever.
Yeah, actually that's a good question, because I think he was cross-examined during the CPS proceedings and acknowledged that he never diagnosed her as that. In fact, his diagnosis of her at one point was, I think, in the midst of the divorce proceedings. I can't remember exact psychological term that he used, but it basically had to do with being depressed or stressed undergoing a divorce proceedings, and that's how he diagnosed her. I think he acknowledges to the parent's attorney in the CPS proceeding that he never diagnosed her as
histrionic. Histrionic personality disorder diagnosis
comes from the two other doctors, I believe.
Dr. Rhodes.
Not from Dr. Rhodes, although, I'm sorry.
So your reading of the record is Dr. Rhodes would not have testified that she had histrionic personality
disorder. No, he would have testified, although I question that being his diagnosis. He's saying that he didn't diagnose her that. He acknowledged he didn't diagnose her that way initially when she was meeting with him. But that later on down the road, he saw the other reports and thought.
Can an expert witness rely on expert opinions of other experts?
He can. I think the rules allow that.
So is it your position that this testimony on this issue was not material? Why wouldn't it satisfy the Pacetti test?
I think that for several reasons. I don't see the connection with the legitimate need for that. I don't think somebody, just because they have a particular disorder, that necessarily means that they have the propensity any more than anyone else to lie. And I think that there was a reason they wanted to present her as histrionic, as these types of cases most often go. I also question the relevance for the similar reasons that I just said here. And I don't think that it makes the inference, the desired inference, more probable that she coached her daughter and that she's lying about everything.
What about the statement by the child that her mother told her it's okay to lie and not tell dad, is how I understood the statement.
Okay, that one.
It's okay not to lie to dad.
I think it was okay not to lie. It's okay to lie sometimes and even not to tell dad. Yeah, and I believe that was some testimony there's no context of that. Like, what context did that come out? Did it come out in the sex abuse? I don't believe so. I think the context of it might have been that they put eyeshadow on the little brother and don't tell him about that. There's some other dynamics going on within the family involving other siblings.
Your view of that, it's not material because it arose in a different context?
I think so. Based on this record, we haven't been able to see what the context of it was so that we can see that direct relevance and materiality.
Is your argument in response to Mr. Hart is that if there were things that went on in the motion in limine conference that we don't know about, and you think that trial counsel was ineffective, then you should be filing a Rule 40 and not doing it on direct appeal? Or how do we resolve the uncertainty as to what happened? Obviously, there was apparently a conference to discuss the motion in limine after which the court made its ruling, but how do we deal with that aspect of the case?
I think the fact that we don't have a lot of affirmative objections or objections period on the record logically leads to the conclusion that defense wasn't objecting to some of the parameters. Now, we don't know if they went specifically through these five areas they wanted to get to. It may have been something that Mr. Takahashi just decided he wasn't going to get into for strategic reasons.
What strategic reasons would those be? Why would he not want to have his witness say those things?
Well, I don't know what Mr. Takahashi was probably thinking. I don't know that you know, having the mother, having someone, an expert come up and say that she's histrionic and that all these things are lies because mother is this way and daughter is this way. I don't know that that's really the strategy he was going for.
So you disagree with Mr. Hart's characterization of this potential evidence as being probative or significant in terms of proving the potential bias of the mother or the coaching aspect of the case?
I do. Right. I disagree. And I just wanted to comment on the medical records issue that you raised, Judge Nakamura. There were no medical records, to my knowledge, that were made a part of the record on appeal in this case through the defense or the state. So that whole issue is, for whatever reason, they chose not to do it. But they had the testimony with respect to that defense. So unless there's any other further questions. Oh, yes.
Yes, you understand it. What would the testimony of Dr. Rose have been and the basis for his opinion that there was coaching in this case? Or is that even correct?
It's in the record, in the CPS proceedings, there is a summary of there's Dr. Rose's testimony that's attached to the motion in limine. It's the very thick one. No, I think, you know, I'm sorry, Judge. At one point, there's been characterizations of the mother as a manipulative schemer, that she's histrionic and that she was sexually abused as a child. I think that last one is something that Dr. Rhodes put great weight on, that as she was sexually abused as a child, therefore she's high likelihood, there's a higher likelihood that she's going to coach a child and that she did in fact coach this child. He sees inconsistencies in the in her disclosures. Dr. Rhodes also talked about the interviewing techniques of Hinda Diamond, the CPS worker, the lack of medical evidence, which again is not unusual in these types of cases. So it's a mix of all those things that he sees to support his opinion that she was coached. And yet, Judge Wilson does deal with some of those factors in his findings. He found Hinda Diamond didn't lead her and have inappropriate questions, that he acknowledged there was no medical evidence to support. Although Dr. Michaels does speak to his testimony out, he did not do an even more in-depth examination based on the allegations that were made. So that's what my understanding is of what Dr. Rhodes based his opinion of coaching.
You have two parts to your argument. One part is that the proffered testimony or on appeal is something that's precluded by privilege, the privilege law. But you also have an argument that this is inappropriate expert testimony?
Correct.
Aside from the privilege. In other words, even if there was no privilege, you would still be arguing the court should not have permitted this because you can't call an expert to opine that somebody coached somebody else.
Absolutely. I firmly believe that after all the research I've done. The coaching just shouldn't be coming in the issue.
Found that there was error with regard to this in your view. That error have been harmless or not, and considering the evidence as Mr. Hart has characterized it, or your own view of the evidence, the closeness of the evidence.
My own view of the evidence, I would have to argue that any error was harmless. When you look at the individual aspects of the statements he wanted Dr. Rose to testify to. Thank you.
Mr. Hart, obviously, we're focusing in on the State versus Pacetti case and its relevance here, and how the specific testimony that Dr. Rhodes might have given would play out under that test. So, I guess if you talk about your views on the applicability of that test and how it would apply to the specific things that Dr. Rhodes would have testified to, that would be helpful and important.
I'm going to address precisely that because. In the moments I had, I was able to locate information that would give the answer to your earlier question about how much therapy with whom and when. And the answer is, in Dr. Rhodes' report that would have been part of his testimony but wasn't permitted, we can only conclude that it wasn't permitted because it wasn't in the trial, and his testimony from the family court, while it might have been appended to some motion, was never admitted. And Dr. Rhodes observed that the patient attended 10 of 12 scheduled sessions with Mark Dickner, PhD, between May 5th, 2000 and August 31st of 2000, and that therapist, and the point is here that a therapist may rely on what others find, noted that, quote, she has demonstrated a strong desire to learn more about the dynamics of incest and how to be a protective parent to her two young children. So you'd think that her heart was right in the right place, and so was her mind. But then, in the therapeutic process that Dr. Rhodes experienced previously, he says that Ms. Mitchell, Karen Mitchell, entered psychological treatment with Dr. Rhodes on 1/30/96 in a joint session with Bob Mitchell, and she attended 5 individual sessions on February 22nd, 96, February 26th, 96, 3/18/96, 7/8/96, 4/6/2000, and joint sessions with Bob Mitchell on 1/30/96, 3/8/96, and 4/1/98. So there was obviously a sufficient basis for him to conclude what he concluded. And what was his diagnostic impression? What would he have testified to? How would this evidence have gotten in other than by waiving or setting aside the psychotherapist-patient privilege and any other statutory or rule-based prohibitions, diagnostic?
But under what theory?
Yes.
I mean, normally we don't handle trials by calling psychologists and asking them, okay, well, did you treat so and so? Well, what do you think? What's your expert opinion about whether they're lying or telling the truth?
No, we don't.
That's the function of the trier of fact.
No, we don't do that.
Why?
We don't do it.
Give me, why is this a different context than that?
It should have been done not that precisely.
You want the psychiatrist to testify that he rendered this diagnosis of histrionic personality disorder, and that based upon his analysis of her, the mother is essentially lying or coaching the child to lie. Why isn't that
the mother is manipulating the child because of her own personal issues to say things that are false? We're not talking about a comment on credibility, although I agree with what you noticed about Patangan. It's always concerned me that we have, without analysis, tried to apply it two ways, and it only applies in the way that Patangan says it applies. But here's what Rhodes would have said, which I think Judge Rechtenwald was asking me to address, if I might. Quote, the patient had first entered treatment, referring to Karen Mitchell, due to a strained marital relationship and having recently gone through childbirth of her second child. The patient then re-entered treatment at the time of the reported allegations of sexual abuse of the minor daughter. This is the one that was closed by CPS. There was no evidence, just like there was no evidence on the second and on the third one. You know what the evidence was and wasn't. It was for this reason that the diagnosis of adjustment disorder with depressed mood was given. It would also be reasonable to give Mrs. Mitchell an access to diagnosis of histrionic disorder, which plays right into the notion of the focus of life's attention should be on her, and Munchausen syndrome by proxy would be the next step from that. The patient has a significant history of sexual abuse that apparently has not been addressed in psychotherapy to a large extent. She has admitted to crushes on gay men, participation in one satanic ritual, and a recent affair during her marriage with Mr. Robert Mitchell. She reported that her daughter was sexually touched by her then husband, Mr. Mitchell, in 1996. She proceeded to allow the children to live with the father for at least 3 weeks subsequent to the reported abuse. There's something wrong here. If the woman is claiming there was sexual abuse, why is she allowing them to live with Bob? The patient reportedly had an affair with a boyfriend that used drugs and would have, as reported by her, have been a child abuser. What about the boyfriend? That would have come in. She was arrested for soliciting drugs and reportedly has utilized the same drugs. The patient exposed both of her minor children to an environment of drugs and illegal behavior. Ms. Mitchell appears to lack basic parenting skills and has on repeated occasion placed the children in dangerous situations. So Rhodes would have given that background. It didn't come in. It was kept out by the motion in limine. One's entire sense about whether Hannah is telling the truth. Was it the folder to come and tell that she was touched
aside,
the mother?
Aside from the allegations of abuse that the mother had been the victim of, all the things you mentioned were introduced into evidence. The prior alleged false 1996 allegations, the bias of the mother because of the divorce, the custody issue. I mean, that was the defense argument in the case that the mother coached the child, notwithstanding the fact that Dr. Rhodes was not permitted to testify. So I guess my question is, what would Dr. Rhodes' testimony have added except for an expert opining, based upon the evidence that was already admitted, that the mother coached the child? Isn't that what the trier of fact is supposed to do? Without an expert telling the trier of fact.
The trier of fact couldn't do it completely. The trier of fact could not get the full picture. The trier of fact could not make judgments about whether this child was coached, even though it seemed clear that the mother told the child, you go down there and tell the CPS worker that daddy touched you, and you go down there with pictures. Oh, no, I didn't have anything to do with drawing the pictures. What does our common sense tell us? What do mothers do? Dr. Rhodes could put the flesh on these assertions. Dr. Rhodes could give the background. Dr. Rhodes could make the difference between an innocent man being convicted or not. This case involves a miscarriage of justice of the first order. Mr. Mitchell was entitled to have a trial where all of the potential evidence could have come in so that the trier of fact would not have to resort to what didn't happen as his basis for finding or making conclusions about what he thinks might have happened or he claims did. I have to tell you that I think yes, but without the opportunity to develop it in a hearing, after all, I became. It could be, and we could go back to Rule 40 and start over, but, you know, this was bad enough, so we should just start over with a new trial. And the matter regarding Judge Sakamoto being the judge is not insignificant, I respectfully urge. And the court should hold our lower court judges to their representations on the record to a defendant when taking a waiver. Nothing's more important than the defendant knowing who his trier of fact will be.
You should say that it could be me or some other judge.
It should be clear, because who's going to waive without knowing who the trier of fact is? Life depends upon who the people are that you're dealing with. We have no idea that the lawyer even addressed it with him.
That could be addressed in Rule 40 as well.
Well, it could. We could have a lengthy hearing, but you know, in the situation that Mr. Mitchell found himself, Judge Sakamoto was mostly the judge in his case throughout the substantive proceedings. We had others in there to hold Thomason in contempt and continue dates and things like that, but it was basically Judge Sakamoto. And the change on that occurred just a week before the trial, not with a statement like, now, Mr. Mitchell, we're going to have a different judge in your case, but simply a kind of offhanded reference at the end. The matter's referred to Master Callan.
Now, you would have told your counsel, you would have told your client you could have ended up with a judge, right?
Would I have? If there was any doubt about it, it would have been the focus of our discussions. But when Judge Carl Sakamoto said, that will be me, I'll be the judge, and then just a week before the trial, it's suddenly off to someone else. Maybe I would have said, okay, we're done with this, depending on who it is. I happen to know that Judge Wilson doesn't have any children. He wouldn't understand what it means to put desitin and A&D ointment on. And he wouldn't notice or see what those implements are. I recognize them in a minute because as a parent, we know about giving liquid medication to our children. And we know that if you stuck one of those things in a child, there'd be serious injury, not something that would heal in 2 days. This was unfair, and I ask you to reverse the conviction in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement and stands in recess.
All right. Now recess.